It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about how science is changing the world of craft beer brewing.
First, GE has announced that it's closing its Waukesha gas engine plant. The shutdown will occur over the next 20 months as GE builds a new facility in Canada to take over the production done in Wisconsin.
The factory, which is part of the GE subdivision GE Power and Water, employs 350 Wisconsinites and contributes millions of dollars to the economy through contracts with suppliers around the state. President Barack Obama toured the facility in January 2014.
GE officials blame the closure on the political battle in Washington over the Export-Import Bank and those who call for its elimination.
Joining us now to explain the work of that institution and its connection to jobs here in Wisconsin is Craig Gilbert. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be with you.
So this announcement of the Waukesha plant closing over the next 20 months or so, was this anticipated by local leaders?
Well, there have been signals that from GE that unless Congress reauthorized the Export-Import Bank, that they would cease production in some places in the U.S. and move those jobs to countries that have export financing. So if you were paying attention and following this issue closely, then it wasn't a shock that GE did this.
And the impact, 350 jobs directly, and there's talk of a ripple effect with suppliers, other things that are based on the existence of this plant. How big a deal is this for the region, for the state?
Well, you know, there's lots of different ways to look at that. I mean, in pure numerical terms, it's not huge, obviously, because you're talking about a few hundred jobs in a state of, you know, of millions of people. But for the people that are losing their jobs and the people that are living in an area that could be affected economically, it's a huge deal.
GE Vice Chairman John Rice said the political battle over the renewal of the Export-Import Bank is the main reason, a prime reason they're choosing to close the plant. And let's dig into that a little deeper, Craig. What does the Export-Import Bank do?
The Export-Import Bank provides different kinds of financial backing to companies, to U.S. companies that are exporting their products. They're engaging in commercial deals with other people overseas. And in some cases, they're doing deals where the financing wouldn't exist in the private sector for the kind of deal that's being done. And that's where the Export-Import Bank steps in and provides financial backing.
And then at the federal level, the Export-Import Bank has become a political football. Can you talk about the political debate over renewing the Export-Import Bank?
Yeah, well, it's basically in part a debate across party lines. I mean, Democrats are pretty overwhelmingly supportive of the Export-Import Bank, but within the Republican Party, there's a big split. You know, for some conservative Republicans, pro-market Republicans, the Export-Import Bank represents the government kind of intervening in the private sector in a way that's kind of fundamentally anti-market. And for others, it's just who view it in more bottom-line terms. You know, you've got 60 countries around the world that have institutions like the Export-Import Bank, and their argument is that if we don't match that, we're not, you know, companies in the U.S. aren't going to be able to compete on a level playing field with these foreign companies, and they're going to lose out to their competitors. But it is very much, the split is very much within the Republican Party. Probably a majority, or I think easily a majority of both houses of Congress that would vote to support reauthorizing the Export-Import Bank. But because, for example, in the House, Republicans control the House, the opposition within the Republican Party has prevented a vote from taking place on reauthorization this year.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a GE plant closure announced for Waukesha and blamed by the company on the politics over the Export-Import Bank. Craig, how does that split play out among Wisconsin's congressional delegation?
Well, in the House, again, talking about the split within the Republican members of the delegation, the last time the House voted on reauthorization in 2012, Sean Duffy and Reid Ribble, who are still serving but were freshmen at the time, both voted to reauthorize the Export-Import Bank. But Paul Ryan and Jim Sensenbrenner and Tom Petri, who's no longer in Congress, all voted against. Ryan is probably the most adamant opponent in the delegation to the Export-Import Bank. His opposition is, you know, could be described as categorical in the sense that he believes and argues that this is just the wrong mission for an agency of this kind. He doesn't want to reform the Export-Import Bank. He wants to get rid of it. Jim Sensenbrenner has argued for changes in the Export-Import Bank. He said that he can't support it as it's currently constituted. One of the arguments he makes, and that some critics of the Export-Import Bank make, is that it can have sort of perverse unintended consequences, that by helping, you know, one individual U.S. company, it can have the effect, for a variety of reasons, of hurting other U.S. companies, and the government is, in effect, picking winners and losers. Those are some of the arguments that are made against it. In the Senate, Ron Johnson voted against reauthorizing the Export-Import Bank in 2012, but there was a vote just this past July in the Senate in which he voted in favor of reauthorizing it.
With this GE announced closure in Waukesha, there's been some skepticism over GE saying, hey, it's this Export-Import Bank thing that's causing the problem. Some supporters or opponents, I should say, of the Export-Import Bank who want to get rid of it say, this is about tax rates, corporate tax rates looking better in Canada right now than in the United States. Has that been the general reaction for people from critics of the Export-Import Bank?
Well, I think it's natural that, you know, that critics of the bank, are going to downplay the impact of not having the bank around on these kinds of decisions. You know, we can only sort of operate from what GE is saying, and it's certainly quite possible that there are other factors in play. The argument that opponents of the Export-Import Bank make is that the way to help U.S. companies compete is not with sort of government financing of exports, but by changing our tax code, lowering our corporate tax rate, and deregulating. So there, again, you're kind of getting back to a very kind of ideological debate that the Export-Import Bank is sort of caught up with in the first place.
The jobs, the production from this Waukesha plant going to Canada, as we've mentioned, that's not usually where you think of when you think of international outsourcing from the United States. You think maybe south of the border or to Asia. Why is GE saying they want to move to Canada?
Because there is something like the Export-Import Bank in Canada. Right, we're used to hearing about jobs being moved to countries where the comparative advantage for the American company that's moving the jobs is just cheaper labor, for example. But in this case, we're talking about the comparative advantage being kind of more potential for government assistance, which is a very different but still kind of a bottom-line concern for companies. So in this case, you've got kind of American jobs, in some cases, falling victim to cheaper labor overseas, in other cases falling victim to the fact that other developed nations are providing a kind of assistance that the U.S. isn't providing right now.
There's been a push to get the Export-Import Bank reauthorized just in recent days. As we wrap up, Craig, how likely is that looking now?
Well, the one wrinkle now, of course, is the planned announced departure of House Speaker John Boehner. John Boehner has been sympathetic to the Export-Import Bank. The man who's replacing him, Kevin McCarthy, is very much an opponent. So clearly, under a McCarthy speakership, the prospects would be very bleak for reauthorizing the Export-Import Bank. Supporters are hoping that there's a brief window while Boehner is still the speaker for him to move a vote over the objections of conservatives in his caucus. And so they're keeping their fingers crossed that could happen in the short term. But if it doesn't happen in the very short term, it's probably not going to happen in the foreseeable future.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
That's Craig Gilbert. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel.
Science is changing how some brewers make beer. While beer making has typically been thought of as an art, science plays a big role. Some brewers hope that by incorporating science, beer will be thought of as diverse and as distinct as wine.
Todd Piddock is here to explain how science is changing brewing. He's a writer whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, National Geographic Traveler, and other national publications. You can find his piece, Brewing Better Beer with Genetics, at discovermagazine.com. Todd, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, for people who have never tried making their own beer, I've watched it done. I've never done it myself. Give us the basics. What's the outline of the process to make a beer?
Well, you start with, and I want to preface this, I'm not a beer maker myself. I'm a beer drinker, and and that kind of got my curiosity going. Look, you have some basic ingredients. You got water, hops, a grain, which is usually barley and yeast. You know, you soak the grain. It sprouts. You heat it. There's a drying process that stops it from germinating and isolates enzymes, and they call that malting. Then you have this malt. It's ground up. You put it in hot water. That turns starches into sugars. They call that mashing, and that creates this kind of slurry, this broth called wort. That gets, you drain that, bring it to a boil, you add hops and other things. There's all kinds of things being added in the world today. Then as that cools, you add the real magic ingredient, the live yeast, and that begins to eat up the sugars, which releases carbon dioxide and alcohol. So I don't know if that got real technical. Sorry, and then you get to fermentation, and you have your beginnings of your beer.
That's what I was looking for, and a lot of those things I think are, you think of them as a craft or maybe an art of doing those, but now it seems like more and more science is entering the picture. So how are people trying to get really analytical and take science into their craft beer making?
Well, there's an interesting background here, okay, which is that originally, back in the day when they started to mass produce beer, and the whole alcohol world is actually returning to its roots of craft because people used to make things in their backyard all the time. But the big companies started to bring science. They are the ones who introduced the science and the laboratory into the brewery. And they did that really for economic reasons. They wanted to figure out how to scale up and to make beer cheaper. And then the craft guys came in and they really spurned that. They started to want to experiment and they really chucked science. It was all going to be by feel. It was the art of beer. But that had its limitations. And now various things happen in the second, in the next wave of craft beer that made the craft guys start to look at science in a somewhat different way.
And what? How did they start doing that? How did they start rethinking the role of science in their beer?
First of all, embracing science and starting to pick out different flavors. And start to ask themselves why they were getting certain things so the batches weren't so random. And then you had this other thing started to come on as the companies got a little bit bigger, which was actually a big move in the whole world of science, which is genome mapping,
mm-hmm.
Right? So the just like we started to map human DNA, and as that science progressed, and it progressed very quickly, it became more affordable to begin to put yeast under the microscope and look at its DNA and patterns and sequencing and then from that infer or work out how you could change things to alter flavor profiles.
And the idea is that yeast, different kinds of yeast, different strains, I guess, have different flavor profiles. So we're actually getting to the point where we can look at the DNA of the yeast and start figuring out a link between the genes and the final outcome?
Yeah, exactly. And so there are companies, for example, so somebody makes a beer, and it's something about it happens in it, and it produces what people in the business call off flavors, meaning that their flavors are off the mark of what they had intended to create. Sometimes that means a mistake and the batch is ruined, but sometimes you taste it and you say, hey, that wasn't what I was aiming for, but that was pretty good. And so they can then go back and say, well, what happened under a microscope and replicate it, whereas before you couldn't really do that. The net result of it all is that the world of beer is really expanding, and over time we're going to see greater flavor profiles. If you take the world of wine or other alcohols, you probably had a broader continuum of flavors, greater variety, and beer may get there.
That's amazing to me because you go to a store, a well-stocked beer store, and there are so many different types of beer, flavors. People are talking about beer, as you mentioned, as they talk like wine. With this new genetic research into the yeast and other elements of science, we're going to see maybe even a bigger explosion of varieties of beer?
You know, that's what a lot of people say. And so one of the things you're seeing, if you go into a lot of bars today, the big trend is in Brett beers. Brett is short for Brettanomyces, and if that sounds a little overwhelming, you'll also hear people refer to them as sours, wild yeast beers. And so Brett's are a great example. And that's why, actually, in my story in Discover, I kind of lead with a story about a very pioneering young a brewer named Chad Jacobson at Crooked Stave in Denver. Brettanomyces is this is a wild yeast compared with Saccharomyces, which is domesticated yeast. Historically, you mentioned Brettanomyces to, say, a winemaker, and they start to sweat. It's something that you can't control. It's
you want
wild.
To keep this stuff out, usually.
You want definitely want to keep it out of your barrels. It's going to ruin everything. And so guys like Chad and other brewers are using, you know, very putting all this under the microscope to understand what happens in the wild yeast to manipulate and find new flavors, because this is a whole world of beer that was largely avoided before. So you're seeing this is already proliferating, kind of like the wild yeast. It's proliferating across the world of beer, and you're getting a whole flavor range. And Chad, for example, objects to the term sours because they're now, as they start to control the flavors, they're not all sour. They're not all that mouth-puckering thing. I don't know if you've tried any of them.
I haven't, no. But they're not all sour.
No, they might be lightly tart. You might get fruitiness. You get actually, they're probably closest on the spectrum of flavor, many of them, to wine. You get what's called vinous or wine qualities to them.
We're talking to Todd Pittock about the science of beer, a lot of new research going on that could lead to a lot of new kinds of beer. And, Todd, the science is also bringing back old, ancient beers. Can you talk about what's going on there with people trying to recreate beers from 3 to 7,000 years ago?
Right. So there's a neat story. One of the most prominent brewery has been Dogfish Head, a Delaware brewery. A number of years ago, they had a gathering at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology to host a dinner which was meant to recreate food, what people were eating and drinking at a funeral feast. And so as kind of an experiment, they scraped these ancient bronze vessels one of the archaeologists had, and then he put that under the scope, using various methods, and recreated this beer, which is Midas Touch, although now they have a whole line of them, that looked at, that essentially recreated what was being drank, thousands of years ago. I think the oldest one, as you said, was 9,000 years old. It was called Chateau Jiahu, and it was a Chinese beer made from rice, honey, and fruit.
And tying it all together, Todd, with the genetic research, are we able to know, hey, the yeast they used is the great, 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 et cetera, grandparent of yeast we might be using now in beer?
You know, it's a great question, and I may not be the right person to answer that one. But as you say, there's a whole continuum, and I guess we look out into the future, pretty exciting what we can look forward to.
Have you been able to try any of these recreations of ancient brews yourself?
Yeah, I have. Well, they're all commercially available. I'm actually a big fan of Midas Touch.
And so describe the flavor. Talk us through what that tastes like. So this is rediscovered by scraping a bronze vessel, maybe associated with the famous King Midas. The bronze didn't turn to gold. What does the beer he drank, the brew he drank, taste like?
There's a grape must in it. There's a kind of sweetness. It's discernible as beer, for sure. It has a kind of softness, a sweetness, it has its own characteristics. I wouldn't describe it in terms of its malt and hops the same way as some other beers.
All right, Todd, thanks a lot for joining us. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
That was Todd Pittock, a writer whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, National Geographic Traveler, and other national publications. We've been talking about the newest cutting-edge science behind craft beer production. You can find his piece, Brewing Better Beer with Genetics, at discovermagazine.com. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. A new bill released yesterday would overhaul Wisconsin's civil service system and make it easier to hire and fire state employees.
The bill was drafted by Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke and Senator Roger Roth. Last week, Governor Scott Walker said he supported the proposal to change the civil service system to attract better candidates for state jobs.
We're getting two perspectives on this proposal. The first comes from Representative Jim Steinke, Majority Leader of the Wisconsin State Assembly, who represents the 5th District, which includes Kaukauna. He's one of the authors of the bill. Representative Steinke, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me.
Well, why do you think that the state's civil service system needs changing?
Well, after talking with state agencies over the last few months, it became clear that changes were needed given what we're looking at in the next few years. In just 5 years, 23% of the state's workforce is going to be eligible for retirement. And 10 years out, that balloons to 40%. So what we're really concerned about is getting people in the door in a timely fashion and attracting the best quality candidates. And currently, when the state's hiring process takes anywhere from 100 to 200 days, sometimes even more, just to hire a single candidate, oftentimes when these agencies are making job offers, their best candidates are already gone and accepting other jobs in the private sector.
Now, in addition to that, you're looking at eliminating state exams. Tell us what that would entail.
Basically, we go, just like the private sector does, we eliminate the state exam and go to a resume-based system, so it's based more on merit, not an arbitrary score on an exam. I think that's really important, especially given some of the stories that we've heard from agencies where they were looking for, like one agency was looking for an accountant. The state test identified as one of the top candidates a short order cook who had no relevant financial experience. Now, that might be an outlier, but I know there are several other occasions where things like that have happened. So a resume-based system that the private sector uses all the time, I think, is something that makes sense for the state.
Now, opponents of that bill, and in particular the state exams, say that getting rid of the exams mean that the jobs would be ripe for the powers doing the hiring to simply maybe hire their friends or people who agree with their political agenda. What do you make of that critique?
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up because that's one of the things that I'm just perplexed by as far as the opponents' arguments on this. I just don't think that they've read the bill. The bill actually keeps in place all the prohibitions against hiring and firing based on political affiliation. That was very important to us, that we keep the core civil service protections in place, but we're just really modernizing the system.
And what about concerns that eliminating the exams could bypass employees who have relevant expertise?
I think it's just the opposite. I think the resume-based system allows a more in-depth look at somebody's experience and related, the related experience in order to attract the best candidates.
Could you tell me a little bit about what kind of research you did to come up with what you thought would fix the state system?
Most of the things that are in the bill came out of discussions with state agencies and some things on what other states have done. Other states have gone much farther than we propose in this. Some other states have eliminated civil service protections entirely. We think it's incredibly important to keep those civil service protections in place, but yet modernize them so they're relevant going into the next few decades here.
We're talking with Representative Steinke right now, Majority Leader of the Wisconsin State Assembly, representing the 5th District. We're talking about his bill that would overhaul the state's civil service system. And looking at the way that employees could be hired or fired, now we've talked a bit about the hiring. What about the firing? How would that work?
Well, basically, I think this is where the bill becomes incredibly employee-friendly, because under current state law, there really isn't a definition of just cause. The only thing that's in there under just cause is abandonment of somebody's position. And currently under state law, which is really mind-boggling to me, is the only way you can fire somebody for abandonment of their position is if they're They don't show up, and they don't call for five consecutive days. It's just bizarre to me that somebody could be gone and not show up, not call for four consecutive days, and you could not use that as a reason to fire. But the way this becomes really employee-friendly is we define very bright lines in state statute what just cause is. And then a just cause for immediate termination would be things like stealing from the state, watching pornography on state computers, abandonment of the position, sexual harassment, things that everybody can agree are egregious acts and should be grounds for immediate termination.
Now, your bill also extends the state's six-month probationary period for new employees to 2 years. Why 2 years?
Well, this is another thing that I think is a benefit to employees, because one of the things that agencies have to look at it during that six-month period is after that 6 months, they pretty much have to count on having that person on the state payroll for a very lengthy time going forward. So at that six-month period, they have to decide whether they can see a future with this employee or not. Extending that out to 2 years gives the agencies more time to work with the employee, more time for that employee to grow into the position, which I think is a great benefit to employees. Because sometimes at that six-month mark, if the agency isn't quite sure if the employee is going to work out or not, sometimes it's better for them, under current law, to just jettison the employee and start all over than take the chance going forward.
Now, critics say that these changes would weaken protections against, for job security, and that having that probationary period extend for 2 years in general makes state service less desirable. And if the goal is to get qualified, competent candidates in the door, do we want to make it more desirable and more secure?
Absolutely. We do want to make it more desirable, but we also don't want to make a state job a permanent property right. You know, we want to move people up that are through state employment that are doing a great job for the taxpayers of the state. We don't want it to just be something that, well, they've gotten the job, they've gotten past their six-month probationary period, now they have this job for the next 30 years. So we want the best and the brightest. I think by far the state workforce is doing a great job for Wisconsin, but we can always make the system a little bit better.
Now, does progressive discipline have a place in this bill, or is it simply one of these actions happens that you talked about and it becomes necessary to fire an employee and that happens without any sort of lead up?
No, absolutely. Progressive discipline is still a main part of this, the civil service protections, except in the cases where we're outlined that are egregious, where it's theft or sexual harassment at work or things like that. But the progressive discipline system, the way it works now is the agencies, it's kind of done agency to agency. What we're proposing is that we have a more uniform process throughout all state agencies on how that progressive discipline is handled.
Now let's talk about layoffs next. When they're necessary, your bill would make employee performance the first factor that gets considered. What would that move accomplish, do you think?
Again, our main goal is to make sure the best and the brightest employees are the ones that are serving the taxpayers. So if we have somebody that's been at their position 10 years that is doing a phenomenal job, and then somebody that's been there for 15 years that may not be doing so good, we want to make sure that person that's doing the best job for the taxpayers is the person that we keep, and not necessarily just keep the person around that's been there for 15 years just because they've been around longer. So, again, it's making sure that the state workforce is the best it possibly can be. And we want to reward that effort, too, by instituting merit pay and actually backing it up with money, which I think is incredibly important for the workforce, because the people that are doing a great job for the state deserve a little extra money.
Now, some critics are worried that performance-based layoffs, as you describe them, really mean, as a code for ideologically driven layoffs. What's your response to that?
Again, I think people haven't read the bill. The protections, again, for hiring or firing based on political affiliation are still in the bill. We haven't changed those one bit.
Now, when Act 10 was passed 4 years ago, Governor Scott Walker said that even though state employees can't collectively bargain, the state civil service system is there to protect employees, and now those protections seem to be changing. What would you say to a state employee who's nervous about this bill?
Here's basically what people should take away from this conversation is that if you're a new employee, you're going to have a longer period of time to prove yourself. If you're a good employee, you're never going to notice a change under this bill. And then if you're a great employee, you're going to get more money through merit pay. But in the case that you are, committing a crime on the job, or if you're sexually harassing somebody, yeah, you're going to hate this bill because you're going to be able to get fired quicker.
Representative Steinicke, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Representative Jim Steinicke, Majority Leader of the Wisconsin State Assembly, who represents the 5th District, which includes Kaukauna. He was with us to talk about a bill he authored that would overhaul the state civil servant system. Let us know what you think about this issue over on the Central Time Facebook page. We just heard from Representative Jim Steinicke about a new bill he's co-authored that would overhaul the state's civil service system.
The bill, in a nutshell, would make it easier to hire and fire state employees. Last week, Governor Walker said he approves of an overhaul of the civil service system to help bring in better candidates for state jobs.
Now we're getting another perspective on this news with Rick Badger. He's the executive director of AFSCME, Council 32, the statewide affiliate of AFSCME that covers state employees. Rick, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Veronica.
Well, what do you think about Representative Steinicke's proposal to change, to overhaul the state civil service system?
Well, and I got to hear the last 5 minutes with his comments, and so kind of concerned on two fronts. One, as someone who has read the bill, it still brings up the same concerns that I thought were there last week. And as I kept hearing him, he kept saying, this is employee friendly. And I really wonder which state employees he talked to who really think this is the solution to the problem of keeping state employees in service.
And when you point to areas that you feel are not friendly, which areas jumped out at you?
Well, and again, I heard in his comments talking about, in terms of layoff, what about that employee who's fantastic, who has been on the job 10 years versus one who's been on 15 years? I think there's some problems with the assumption. First off, as someone who represents state employees, we're for having the best workforce possible as well. We're not opposed to that goal. Our concern is it's not going to be that 10-year employee who's fantastic versus the 15-year employee who is good. It may very well be a 5-year employee versus a 25-year employee who costs the state more and is doing a very good job. And as we all know in this world, there is age discrimination. There are other problems on here. And I fail to see, based on what Jim Steinicke, Representative Steinicke, just said, that this really is a way to ensure a better workforce or to treat the employees of the state in a way that truly is fair or, as he says, employee-friendly.
Now, proponents of these changes say the civil service system is a century old and that it doesn't work with modern work problems. What is your response to that?
Well, again, I fail to see what problem we're trying to solve. I mean, this is a state that has seen the legislature and the governor gut all kinds of employee benefits, collective bargaining, has made wage freezes, wage cuts, benefit cuts, and the governor himself promised 4.5 years ago, we're going to leave civil service alone. That's why we don't need to have these union protections you thought you had. Well, now we found out that is not what was really in the cards. This is really about changing a system. And again, I go back to what I heard the representative say. I don't see how this really solves the problems that he's trying to address. I mean, people are leaving state service not because of a lack of merit pay. It's because of the uncertainty and the fact that no one's listening to the state employees and they keep taking things away. That's the problem. This is not the solution.
Now, what do you think of the proposal there to eliminate the use of state exams in hiring and move to a resume-based hiring system?
Well, and again, and I think that if the representative were on this call, he would recognize the fact that resumes are part of the system right now. It's not like that's a new component. But the reason why the state went to an objective exam system was to take the personality out of it, to really look at what really the qualities, what you know, not who you know. And again, I found it very interesting that he thought that resumes were merit-based and that exams were the part that were arbitrary. Take whatever single outlier out of 10,000 exams out of the picture. The real reality is that resumes that have been tested and verified are far more accurate than a resume. I mean, national surveys show that 1 out of 5 resumes are grossly inaccurate. I mean, so relying on resumes as your merit-based approach really fails even at first blush.
Now, critics, some like yourself, have been concerned that getting rid of the civil service exam would make the atmosphere ripe for cronyism in appointing friends, people who agreed on political grounds, and the representative there saying no, that especially on political grounds, that core protection against that is still intact in the bill. Is that your understanding?
Well, you have those protections in there, but it inserts all kinds of new measures for discipline. And as someone who's read both the bill and what Representative and Senator Roth put out yesterday, let's look at the fact that it's no longer work performance that's judged. It's also personal conduct that's defined as being either inadequate, unsuitable, or inferior. Again, living in an environment where we know that we have top leadership, including the governor, who have used political power and influence, who is to judge what inferior, unsuitable, and inadequate really means as far as personal conduct? I mean, this is not just work performance. This is adding whole new layers on how to judge somebody and to get rid of an employee. These are reasons to be concerned for those who have looked at what the representative has put out and what he has said and what's in the actual bill.
We're talking with Rick Badger right now, executive director of Ask Me Council 32, the statewide affiliate that covers state employees. He's talking about a new bill that we discussed earlier in the hour as well that would make it easier to hire and fire state workers. Now, another area that we talked about was the probationary period and extending this from its current 6 months up to 2 years. How do you see that change?
Well, first off, I don't know which private sector employers he's looking at to use the two-year probation. It seems to be that this was based on his experiences with private sector employers and maybe talking to some department heads in state government. But put that aside for a moment. If there's a question about whether 6 months is right or a year or whatever, maybe this is another one of those cases where we should be, looking at the situation. Does that solve a problem that's really there? Are we really having a lot of employees who are either terminated prematurely or extended when they shouldn't be? And again, I keep going back to what is the intent of this bill, and does this really deliver on what Representative Steinicke is saying needs to be done?
Now, to the best of your knowledge, have state workers themselves been consulted about the changes that could be needed? He mentioned us, Representative Steinicke, talking to several agencies, but do you know how broad that has been? What is your sense?
Well, again, and we could spend a whole other show talking about the shortages, the Department of Corrections, the people who have left employment early, the people who are scared for their jobs. What we have here is a climate of fear where employees are terrified of speaking out in the workplace. I mean, this is not your normal workplace these days. So imagine if you do with the little protections the employees already have. That's why it was created, because working for state government, years ago, was... there was lots of corruption. There was a lot of cronyism. Why even insert the hint or possibility when it's not necessary? Again, this is solving a problem that doesn't exist, and employees that I talk to aren't talking about, boy, I wish we had more merit pay, or boy, I wish there was more reasons I could be terminated. Instead, they're asking for, why am I not getting a decent pay raise? Why are my benefits cut? And can I really make a decent living working for the state or have a long-term career here? And those are the things that Representative Steinicke's bill does not address. In fact, makes things worse for the state of Wisconsin and for its employees.
Now, starting from square one, when we began speaking, Representative Steinicke said that these measures taken as a whole in the bill would make it easier to bring people into state employment and that there was a need. There were holes to be filled, and the state needs to do it faster and make sure that they have the best and the brightest. Is that reasonable? Would these bills, maybe not all of them, but aspects of them, would that help get people in the door and get good people in the door and get them to stay?
Well, let's again take that just step by step. If our goal here is to get the best employees possible, and I share that goal, and I think almost every state employee I've talked to shares that goal, we want a quality workforce, we want to do good work for the public, the taxpayers. So if there's a question about whether we need to have 45-day limits or 30-day limits, let's have that discussion. But that is just a small part of this whole bill. I mean, that's a part where Representative Steinicke says one thing, but what actually happens is quite different. So let's have those discussions. This is the Wisconsin that I love. Let's make state government better. Let's make the system better. But again, this is something where it's being rushed through more because folks think they can do it rather than because it's the best way of making state service better.
Now, just briefly as we wrap up, if this bill were passed, what effect do you think it would have on state employees?
I think it's going to have a chilling effect on the recruiting part of it, which I keep hearing was the intent of this. I mean, I think people probably have questions about why they should go into state service, just like I have friends who are thinking about becoming teachers or are teachers are concerned about that profession in the state of Wisconsin. This does nothing to address the fundamental problems of having a competitive workplace where people feel valued, that they want to do the best service they can for the Wisconsin public. And again, I challenge any listener to read the bill, listen to what Representative Steinecke just said, and see if this is really something that's going to make state service better and more accountable and really better for the taxpayer.
And we leave it there. Rick, thank you for joining us. That was Rick Badger, Executive Director of Ask Me Council 32, the statewide affiliate that covers state employees. He joined us to talk about a new bill that would make it easier to hire and fire state workers. You can hear more about this topic tomorrow after 7 on The Joy Cardine Show.
Proceeding as I have foreseen.
And it is Sith Lords 1, Jedis 0 in New Zealand, where a push from self-proclaimed Jedis, you know, the religion from Star Wars, to get the government to recognize Jediism with tax-free status recently failed.
The Jedi as religious movement began in 2001 when there was an email campaign in England and Wales urging people to write down Jedi for their religion on census forms.
And the Jedi religion took off in New Zealand. Over 53,000 people claimed to be members of the Jedi faith in 2001.
In 2008, a man named Daniel Jones founded the Church of Jediism, and he actually started writing scripture for it, going above and beyond what was expressed in the movies.
So New Zealand says no recognition of the Jedi religion. A member of the New Zealand Jedi Society responded to that decision. He said, not achieving charity status would be disappointing to those without Jedi training. But, he said, disappointment is not a Jedi trait.
And apparently stoicism is a Jedi trait, so he is rolling with it, and the Jedis in New Zealand are regrouping, and they're going to try this again.
I know people have an almost religious attachment to the Star Wars movies. This is taking the whole thing a little step further with a belief in the Force.
Absolutely. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.